Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the True Crime and Coffee Podcast, where I, your host, Simone North, bring you all things true crime, from notorious serial killers, unsolved disappearances, and cases that never made the news. It is here where we talk about the most bone-chilling cases of all time while we drink our coffees to stay calm. Hello, my little detectives, and thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the True Crime and Coffee Podcast. This is the third episode of the True Crime and Coffee Podcast, and I am super, super excited to continue on this journey of bringing light to true crime cases that may have been forgotten about amongst the years, and just to bring the victims some justice, hopefully. From having people listen to this podcast. So, how is everyone doing? I am doing particularly great today. The weather was super, super nice. It is still really nice, even though it's getting a little late now. It's about 8 o'clock at night. But when I woke up today, the sun was shining. There was a cool breeze, but it was still pretty warm outside. It was really, really great. I could drive with the windows down. It was really, really perfect. And to make matters better, I have a delicious cup of hot turmeric ginger tea in my hand, which is my favorite tea of all time. It's the Reishi brand, and it's in my favorite ceramic mug. I don't know about you guys, but I am so obsessed with coffee mugs, especially ceramic mugs. I am just a sucker for a beautiful mug, and it's really, really doing damage on my cabinets because I am running out of space to put my mugs in. It's getting really bad. But anyways, speaking of mugs, I was thinking about how cool it would be if once this podcast gains a little traction, if I came out with a little merch line of some mugs or maybe t-shirts. Obviously, this is still a pretty small and underground podcast, but I'll keep you guys updated once the pay starts picking up because I really, really think it would be super awesome if our little true crime community could all sip out of matching mugs or wear matching t-shirts while we talk about true crime. So, diving straight into today's case, as you can see from the title, we are going to be talking about the disappearance and murder of the Grimes sisters. Now, these were two sisters who shared a love for Elvis and went to see the film Love Me Tender at a Brighton Park theater, only for tragedy to ensue soon after. This is a case that had thousands of people shocked and heartbroken, and even Elvis Presley himself was begging for a safe return of the girls. Sadly, this is something that would not come to happen, and 64 years later, no justice has been brought to these two sisters and their families. Joseph and Loretta Grimes were the parents of seven children, two of which being sisters Barbara, 15, and Patricia, 12. Barbara and Patricia were said to be inseparable sisters, the best of friends, and shared a love for Elvis Presley. They were super devoted fans, and on the night of December 28th, 1956, they had decided to go view the Elvis Presley film Love Me Tender for the 11th time. The girls left their home in McKinley Park, Chicago, an official community in Chicago, at approximately 7:30 p.m. and headed to the Brighton Theater, which was about 1.5 miles away, promising their mother, Loretta, that they would be back before midnight. Now, the two girls were said to be carrying about $2.50 on them, which I looked up, and $2.50 back in 1956 was said to be equal to about around $23.97 now. It is not known how the two sisters traveled to the theater on this date, but the previous times that they had gone to this theater and seen the movie, they had either walked or had taken the bus. Now, Barbara and Patricia had decided to stay and view the second showing of the film, meaning that they would be set to arrive home at approximately 11:45 p.m., 15 minutes before they told their mother that they would be back. When the girls did not arrive home, their mother, Loretta, sent their sister, Teresa, who was 17, and their brother, Joey, who was 14, to wait for the girls at the bus stop closest to their home, while Loretta would contact the girls' friends to see if they were at any of their houses. But this attempt would prove useless, as they were nowhere to be found. Three buses made stops where the two siblings of the girls waited, and the sisters never showed up. And this is when Teresa and Joey went home. When Teresa and Joey arrived home without Barbara and Patricia, Loretta knew something was very, very wrong and filed a missing persons report with the Chicago Police Department at 2:15 a.m. on December 29th. After Loretta reported her two daughters, Barbara and Patricia, missing, a citywide search for the girls was quickly initiated, having hundreds of police officers assigned. The disappearance of the Grimes sisters having sparked one of the largest missing person cases in the history of Cook County. This search not only consisted of hundreds of police officers, but also hundreds of local volunteers. The search began on December 29th with police conducting door-to-door canvassing throughout Brighton Park. Numerous canals and rivers were being dredged, more than 15,000 flyers were distributed to local homes, and a $1,000 reward with information leading to their whereabouts was posted. 300,000 people would be questioned about the disappearance of the girls, and 2,000 individuals would be subject to serious interrogation pertaining to their potential culpability. Two arrests and charges were made against individuals who did confess to the crime, but the charges were later dropped. Now, one of the individuals who was convicted, a man by the name of Edward Bedwell, who we will get to later, stated that he had been coerced into giving a confession. Police put an immense amount of effort into the case, and despite this, the media coverage and numerous reported sightings of the girls, which we will also get into later, there was little to no hard evidence brought in to lead them in the direction of what could have happened. Despite this, several teens did report seeing the two sisters conversing with a man who looked like Elvis Presley and then entering his car. The model of the car was described as being a Mercury model. Several investigators initially assigned to this case had theorized that the girls had left on their own accord, either running away or staying with boyfriends. Reported sightings of people saying that they had seen the girl at local business establishments as late as January 9th supported the theories of these investigators, but their parents did not agree with this and knew that this was completely out of character for their daughters. They wouldn't just up and leave. They wouldn't just run away. They would let their parents know if something was going on. They wouldn't do that to them. There were also theories that the girls may have traveled to Nashville, Tennessee to see Presley in concert, or even left home as a way to live like Presley. Now, fast forward to January 19th, 1957, an official statement was released from Presley's Graceland estate reading, "If you are good Presley fans, you will go home and ease your mother's worries." Elvis himself was also said to have made a direct radio plea to the Grimes sisters, telling the girls to return home to their mother. So this case got so big and so much attention that Elvis Presley himself even put out a statement telling the girls to go home. And that is just crazy and really shows how much people cared about these girls and wanted them to be found. Sadly, all efforts to have these girls returned home to their mother safely were destroyed when the day of January 22nd, 1957 rolled around, and a construction worker by the name of Leonard Prescott would describe seeing flesh-colored things behind a guardrail as he drove down a road named German Church Road. Prescott initially thought that what he had seen was mannequins, but he later returned to the scene with his wife Marie, and they would discover what they had truly seen was the nude and frozen bodies of the Grimes sisters. This scene was so gruesome that it caused Marie to faint upon the scene. The two immediately reported their sightings to the Willow Springs Police Department. The girls' bodies laid upon a flat, horizontal section of a snow-covered ground directly behind the guardrail. Barbara was found laying on her side with her legs drawn slightly up towards her torso, while Patricia was on her back, her body covering her sister's head and her own head turned sharply to the right. It is believed that the girls were not killed at this location, but driven here after their murders and either thrown or dragged out of the car and placed there. Three wounds resembling those of ice picks were found on Barbara's chest, as well as injuries resembling blunt force trauma were visible on her face and head. Numerous injuries resembling bruises were found on Patricia's body. The girl's father, Joseph, was driven to the crime scene to identify the bodies of his daughter, which must have just been so hard and so heartbreaking. I cannot even imagine putting all this effort into finding your two daughters and hoping that they're alive and then being driven down to identify two bodies that did end up being the two girls. There was a search of the crime scene conducted by over 160 police officers and numerous local volunteers, though there was little to no evidence that was discovered, and people were pretty upset with the way that this search was conducted because they believed that many untrained individuals were there to search the crime scene and they could have trampled over evidence at the scene. When you have people who don't know what they're doing investigating a crime scene or looking for evidence, they may not know or they do not know what to look for, what not to tamper with. And, you know, they could be looking over really key parts of the crime. So I don't know why exactly police would let untrained people look for evidence at a crime scene. But that just seems like a very bad call on their part. Now, a 5-hour autopsy was conducted on each of the girls' bodies by three experienced forensic pathologists, though all three were unable to reach an agreement on either a date or a cause of death for the girls. It is believed that the sisters had died within 5 hours of the last time they were seen alive, dating their time of death at either the late evening of December 28th or the early morning of December 29th. Now, the cause of death for the girls was ruled as a combination of shock and exposure, although this was only concluded by a process of eliminating other causes of death. Experts have concluded that many of the wounds found on the girls had most likely been inflicted by rodents, and actual puncture wounds having been inflicted after death. No fatal wounds were found on either of the girls, and toxicology reports showed no sign of being drugged, drunk, or poisoned prior to their deaths. It was also discovered that Barbara had likely engaged in sexual intercourse prior to her death, whether consensually or non-consensually, with no evidence of forcible molestation being found. The death certificates of both Barbara and Patricia would be listed as murder. Despite official conclusions, the chief investigator of the Cook County Coroner's Office, Harry Gloss, disagreed with the girls' official time of death, stating that there had been numerous marks of violence found upon the girls' faces, indicating that they had been victims to violence as opposed to post-mortem rodent infestation. Now, Gloss also stated that a thin layer of ice found on their bodies indicated that they had been alive until at least January 7th, since only after that date was there enough snow to react with their natural body heat and create the layer of ice that was discovered on their bodies. Gloss also stated that the girls had been subject to sexual assaults throughout their time in captivity, saying that the autopsy of Patricia uncovered semen within the vaginal fluid swathed from her body, and that curdled milk had been found in Barbara's stomach, and she was not known to have drank milk at home or at the cinema on the night of her and her sister's disappearance. Harry Gloss strongly believed that official suspect in the case, Edward Bedwell, had been the one who committed these murders, saying that the wounds and assault marks on the girls and evidence of sexual activity were in line with the claims that Bedwell had told investigators in a January 1957 interrogation. Gloss also claimed that investigators had left out details of the case to protect the girls' reputation and spare their mother's feelings. Now, despite these claims, investigators of the case continued to insist that there had been no evidence of either of the girls being disreputable or the recipient of extreme violence or sexual molestation prior to their deaths. When Gloss refused to retract his statements, he was fired, though he would later be deputized by Sheriff Joseph D. Lohman, who concurred with Gloss's statements and allowed him to continue to work on the case without pay. Now, I found this very interesting because if Gloss was completely wrong, if Gloss was making false statements about this case to the media, to the public, I feel like there would be consequences for that. Pretty bad consequences. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you can't just go around spewing out false information about an ongoing case. And the fact that a sheriff allowed him to continue working on the case, but without pay, kind of furthers my belief that he was onto something, but because people didn't like what he was saying, or because they were trying to hide things, they didn't want it to be super known that he was still working on the case. Now, I could be completely wrong, but that is just my personal thoughts on the matter. All right, so now we are going to delve into the sightings of this case, which I find very interesting and very telling. There were more sightings than the ones that I will be listing, but I kind of picked and chose from the list and chose the ones that I thought were most important to the case. You can look up the rest of the sightings, but like I said, these were the ones that I personally found the most important to this case. So the first sighting I picked was that numerous people reported seeing the girls boarding a Chicago Transit Authority bus on Anchor Avenue heading east into the city after the screening, saying that halfway between the theater and their homes, the girls had gotten off of the bus. Now that rings the question of, why would the girls have gotten off of the bus halfway through the route? Were they in danger? Was something wrong? Why would you just get off of a bus halfway home if this was the girls that these people saw? The next sighting was by a man named Roger Menard. Now, he was reported being seated behind Barbara and Patricia at the screening of the film Love Me Tender. He stated that he had left the theater 1 minute before the sisters and was walking behind them down Anchor Avenue when a black 1949 Mercury occupied by two teen boys pulled up beside the girls. He stated that the girls just giggled and continued walking. Jack Franklin, a security guard, told investigators he had given the sisters directions on the morning of December 29th, 12 hours after they had left the theater, saying that the girls had been rude to him. Now, this is very interesting because what were they doing 12 hours after the screening if this was them, and where did they need directions to? Where were they going, and why would they be being rude? Next, a railroad conductor by the name of Bernard Norton reported seeing the two girls board a train searching for two sailors by the name of Terry and Larry. Now, when we get further into this case and the suspect list, a Terry and a Larry are never mentioned, and a Terry and a Larry are never mentioned as being people that these girls knew. So why would these two girls be searching for sailors by that name? Were they people that these girls knew that their parents didn't know of? How did they meet these men? And keep in mind, these girls are young. They're 15 and 13. So why would they be looking for two grown men who were sailors? The owner of a D&L restaurant reported seeing the girls December 30th at 5:40 a.m., saying Patricia was very intoxicated and both girls were accompanied by Edward Bedwell. This one we'll get a little more into further down the list when I start talking about suspects, so just keep this one in the back of your mind. On January 1st, the girls were seen boarding a Chicago Transit Authority bus. The following week, a night clerk at the Unity Hotel stated he had refused the girls a room because of their age. So a week later, after January 1st, puts us at about January 7th or 8th, which I find very, very odd because looking back into what Harry Gloss was saying, he thought that the girls had died no later than January 7th because of the ice that was on their bodies. And the last reported sighting of the girls was either January 7th or January 8th. And there's no other sightings after that, meaning that they very well could have died on January 7th or been placed there then or after. It just doesn't really make sense that the sightings didn't stop any earlier than January 7th, but there was also no other sightings past January 7th. All right, so now diving into the suspects for this case. There were only three suspects for this case. The first one being Edward Bedwell, who I mentioned earlier. Edward was a 21-year-old semi-literate drifter who was tall and strongly resembled Elvis Presley, or at least that's the way he was described. He was from Tennessee, but was evicted from his family's home in 1956. I'm not sure if his family's home was in Tennessee and then he moved to Chicago, or if he was from Tennessee and his family's home was in Chicago. That information was not given. But I know that he was definitely in the Chicago area in 1956, the year that these girls were murdered. The weeks before the Grimes sisters' murders, he was employed as a part-time dishwasher at a Chicago Skid Row restaurant. According to John and Minnie Duros, who were the owners of the restaurant, Edward and his friend had been on the premises with two girls that resembled the Grimes sisters on the early morning of December 30th. So, back to that sighting where they were seen at a D&L restaurant at 5:40 a.m. with the two girls, I think that John and Minnie were probably the ones that reported this to authorities. And it's just really, really odd and suspicious, because why would they put their own employee in the line of interrogation if they truly didn't think that those were the girls that were there? So Edward was interrogated for 3 days, and he was insistent that John, Minnie, and a patron named Renee Eccles, who corroborated their statements, were mistaken in their identification of the girls. Okay, so it was them that reported it. I don't know how I forgot that. But, you know, what's more interesting is that someone else also said that he saw Edward at the restaurant with those girls. It wasn't just two owners. It was someone else too. Edward did end up being charged with the murders on January 27th, 1957, signing a 14-page confession that he and a 28-year-old acquaintance named Cole Willingham were in company of the girls on December 30th until January 7th, drinking with the girls at various West Madison Street Skid Row saloons. And after days in the girls' company, he and Cole, after feeding the girls hot dogs, had beaten the girls and thrown their nude bodies into a snow ditch after the girls refused their sexual advances. After the girls' mother, Loretta Grimes, read this statement, she stated that it was a lie and that her girls would not be on West Madison Street and that they didn't even know where it was. Bedwell later recanted the confession, saying he only provided a confession after being held in custody for 4 days, thinking police would release him if he made a confession. And now this is something that you see a lot in the justice system, is that people will falsely confess to a crime because they just want to leave. They have been there for so long. It's like mental torture, and they start to believe that they really did it, or they'll do anything to leave because it is just such a brutal situation to be in. The autopsy on the girls supported Bedwell's recantation, as no alcohol or hot dogs were found in their stomachs, nor had the girls been beaten to death. So the things that he confessed to didn't really line up with how the girls ended up. Bedwell was also known to have clocked into his place of employment from 4:19 p.m. on December 28th, 1956, to 12:30 a.m. on December 29th, covering the time that the girls were believed to have been abducted. Although there was sightings of the girls later in the night around 2 in the morning on December 29th, which means he could have possibly left work and then abducted the girls, but this is all theories. We don't know anything for sure. As I said, this case is unsolved. Further records have stated that he had been working on the date that he claimed to have murdered the girls. He was freed February 26th on a $20,000 bond, and the same year of his acquittal, he would be charged with the rape of a 13-year-old girl in Oak Hill, Florida. Edward Bedwell, I keep combining his name, he died November of 1972. Now getting into the next suspect, Max Fleig, at least that's how I think you pronounce it, it's F-L-E-I-G, Fleig. He was a 17-year-old boy who was initially considered a prime suspect when the girls first went missing due to his age. And also because of his age, he was protected by Illinois state laws, which prevented minors from subjection to polygraph tests. And although this law was in place, a Chicago police captain by the name of Ralph Pateku, I'm sorry, I'm butchering these names, he had persuaded Max into submitting an unofficial polygraph test where he allegedly confessed to the murders. But because this was an unofficial polygraph test, and the fact that he was a minor, and the fact that they had no evidence to support what Max had said during this, they could not convict him. And also, let's keep in mind that you can't bring a polygraph test to court. It's not valid evidence. So they had nothing to charge him with, and they had to release him. But later, he was jailed for an unrelated murder of another woman, which I think is very, very interesting. It's very interesting that, you know, these suspects, you know, they all seem to be convicted of other awful crimes after the fact and after the case, which just makes them look 10 times more guilty in the murder of these girls, although it couldn't have been the three of them together, so it's really just all theory. But the last suspect is Walter Kranz. He was a 53-year-old steam fitter. He phoned a switchboard operator at Chicago's Central Police Complaint Room on January 15th to inform the operator of his conviction that both sisters were dead and that their bodies would be found in an unincorporated area of the Lyons Township. Now, when he called, he refused to disclose his name, but the operator was able to trace the call to his area, and they ended up finding him and questioning him. The park that he described would end up being a mile away from where the girls' bodies were actually found. And upon questioning, he informed police that several members of his family's and ancestors had psychic powers and that he experienced this vision after a night of heavy drinking. He was initially the number one suspect, and handwriting experts even determined that he may have been the one to write a ransom note to the girl's mother, but he denied any involvement, and he was later released after being subject to multiple interrogations. Walter kind of, to me, just kind of sounds like an odd man, an odd guy. Besides the handwriting thing and the ransom note, it's weird. It's weird that he had this so-called vision, but it definitely doesn't seem like he was the real suspect in this. Now, I don't know if psychics are real. I'm not sure. You know, I don't know much about that. I haven't done my research with that. but he doesn't have any other prior convictions. He didn't get any convictions after the case, so I really think he was just an odd man. So now we are going to talk about the aftermath of this case. So in May 1957 to be exact, Loretta Grimes, the mother of Barbara and Patricia, received a very interesting phone call. Now, she received a phone call from an anonymous man who claimed to have undressed and killed her daughters. This caller ridiculed police efforts to blame suspects such as Edward Bedwell and ended his phone call stating, "I know something about your little girl that no one else knows, not even the police. The smallest girl's toes were crossed at the feet." He then laughed before ending the call. A year after the girls were murdered, their mother publicly stated that they had been murdered by a person that they had known because the girls would not get into the vehicle of someone that they did not know. On the 18th anniversary of the girls' disappearance, Ernest Spiotto, the sole detective and the only detective involved in the investigation of the girls' disappearance from the beginning, stated that there are no credible suspects in the case. The case still remains unsolved, but is open until this day. So in 2013, Raymond Johnson, a retired West Chicago police officer, began his own personal private investigation into this case. Now, Johnson believes that the person who committed these horrendous crimes was none other than 23-year-old child killer Charles Leroy Melquist, who was suspected in the murders in 1957. Melquist was convicted of the 1958 murder of a young girl by the name of Bonnie Lee Scott, who was 15 at the time of her death. Her body was found decapitated 2 months after her disappearance, only 10 miles from where the Grimes sisters' bodies had been discovered. Investigators noted similarities in the murders and body disposals. The day after Bonnie's body had been found, and this is crazy, guys, Loretta had received another phone call from a person who claimed responsibility for her murder. Loretta remained adamant until her death that this caller was the man who had killed her daughters, though Melquist was never questioned because his attorney forbid him to be subject to questioning, and he died in 2010 and was never convicted of the murder of the Grimes sisters. This is absolutely astonishing and crazy to me, because the fact that Loretta receives a call from a man stating something about her daughters, her daughter, that no one else would know, and then made fun of the police for trying to put the blame on Edward, shows that he's keeping up on this investigation. But not only that, he kills Bonnie, and then, you know, allegedly, we don't know if this was the man that killed Bonnie or someone just playing a sick, sick prank, because they did receive sick prank calls. But the man who claimed to have killed Bonnie claimed responsibility for the murder to Loretta. And why would he call Loretta and tell her that if it wasn't to taunt her even further? Because he knew that he would never get caught for murdering her daughters. Well, he thought that he would never get caught for any of the murders. He did, but he did not get charged with all of them. The fact that Loretta thinks that it was him and was adamant that it was him, I don't know if it's a mother's intuition or maybe she just needed someone to put the blame on, but I feel like she was onto something, and the detective who was looking into this was onto something too, because it just seems a little too coincidental. So that is the end of today's case, but I wanted to let you guys know that I did find a GoFundMe dedicated to raising money to help solve this case. I will leave it linked in the description of this podcast. The money will go to solving the case, but if they don't raise enough money, it will be donated to a scholarship in the girls' names. I really hope that you guys enjoyed today's case, and I want to know your thoughts and your theories about this case. You can send me your thoughts, theories, case suggestions to my email, which is truecrimecoffee@gmail.com. And if you want the latest updates about the True Crime and Coffee podcast, follow me on Twitter or Instagram @truecrimecoffee. Thank you so much for listening and for helping to shine a little more light on this tragic, tragic case. And as always, until next time, stay safe.